I'm not suggesting that this work is particularly exceptional. I think there are colleagues, and Borderlands is undoubtedly one of them, doing work of this nature day in, day out, across the whole world, including Europe, of course. And by very definition, by the very act of going out and making these events with people, beginning from nothing and ending up with spectaculars, and sometimes not ending up with performance at all, of course, we are, by the very nature of that act, creating from nothing utopias. Utopias. We're using theatre and performance and the arts to rehearse the very act of imagining something better. For a true nationalist, there is no such thing as a borderland. The very idea of a borderland is an anathema to a true nationalist. Borders, yes. Land, yes. Borderlands, no. My parents' neighbour, when I was a young boy, used to say, good neighbourliness is thanks only to strong fences. It's true that our neighbour was a policeman, and most of our neighbours were policemen. And that's why when my father's car was stolen in 1976, his friend, the policeman, registered the crime and then came back to my dad and said, Joe, I didn't know that you were in the Communist Party. In Northern Ireland during the 1960s and 70s, borders were all the rage. And as a boy, I would watch the BBC television news and see Protestant boys my age preparing their streets with a new lick of paint to the pavements, white, red and blue, colours of the British Union Jack. They were more British than the British, insisting that they were loyal to the Queen and to the Empire. They were, literally, loyalists. The camera would then cut to images of these boys' fathers marching, parading through the streets, not only their own streets, but those of the others, banging their drums as if to frighten the witches out of their houses. And they all seemed to be called Billy or William. There were no borderlands, just borders, or so it seemed. The BBC News would then change to a similar-looking street in Belfast or Derry or Londonderry, where the Irish tricolour would be fluttering from rooftops or blocking windows completely. The same poor houses as in the previous shots, but different colours. The same poor boys looking back at me, but with different names. And the same fathers marching in bands, playing whistles and drums, but dancing to another tune. And in the middle of these two communities, our poor young soldiers, keeping the two enemy groups apart with the use of live ammunition if necessary. What animals, these Irish, my mother would say under her breath. What the BBC News did not make clear was that 95% of the marchers were Protestant and 5% were initiated by the Catholic community. And parading had often been an assertion of a group's control over a particular area. And the most celebrated Protestant parades cut directly through the Catholic streets and territory. The cost of policing these marches in 2012 reached £5.5 million. A sign of the seriousness with which these events still need to be treated, even in the post-conflict era. At 15, around 1977, I visited a family relative in Gosport, a town on the south coast of England and home to the Royal Navy. Dozens and dozens of huge, giant, metallic whales dominated the harbour, calling out to one another from time to time as the evening mist descended. Ships of war, imposing their own logic upon our country's shores. The next morning I walked down to the beach and took off my shoes and walked over the painfully sharp pebbles in search of the sea. The mist was so thick that neither the ships of war nor the very waterline could be seen. And then, with a cold, wet shock, I found myself in the water up to my ankles. The inescapable stop, the inevitable end point. I had reached the watery border. There was no borderland. Here was land, there was wetness and mist. The ships were silent. Were they still there? Or had they slipped off during the night? The pebble beach, I hated it, and I still do. The mist, I detested. Because both could mean only one thing, the inevitable long walk home. Like the Northern Ireland pavement painted red, white and blue, it all seemed so unambiguously clear-cut. The border had been identified, and the answer to Chris's question, what can you see from the borderland, the answer on that day was my wet feet. There would be no going forward from that point. Who needed an iron curtain at 15 years old when there was a deep, wet, cold, grey one? What was the teenager's attraction to the other side of the mist? A human one. Why did he think that those big blue-grey warships were an attempt to scare him away from the watery frontier as much as any invader? Was the world really as hostile, dangerous place on the other side of the mist? Not too far at all, but far enough away to belong to the others? The only really trustworthy foreigners as I was growing up were New Zealanders, because they were English. My Auntie Ellen and Uncle George. Well, not George. He was dead, killed by the Japanese in the war, but that just proved the point. If you left the country, you would be killed by Japanese. Of course, the reality is far more ambiguous, because then I discovered he'd been killed by the Americans while being held prisoner of war by the Japanese. But that took years to discover, and so did a much bigger dirty secret. We were half Irish. And worse than that, we were half Catholic Irish. One day I came home from school to find my uncle in fierce argument with his sister, my mother. My mother was incandescent with rage. And then he stormed out, and we were not to see him for 5 years. Bloody stupid idiot, she said, with his communist ideas and everything. He infected your dad with all that too. And you know, I will never forgive him. I asked her, but what was the argument about? And my sister then joined in. Uncle Dennis is saying that we're from Cork, in the Republic of Ireland. Mum's family are Irish Catholics. And then my mother said, I know why my mother always had sixpence ready to give to the bloody priest. 13 children, a drunk brute of a father, but always a smile for the day the priest came for his sixpence. Stupid sod. Of course, I know where we are from, and it's just nothing to be proud of. It took me years to discover Franz Fanon's book, Black Skin, White Mask, and that it applied to quite different contexts to the one he was describing. As for the question of class and identity and borders, all I'll say is that I was born in Oxford. And there are two Oxfords. One made cars, and the other made philosophers. We made cars. And we sold car insurance on behalf of the Co-op Insurance Society, which was the only job a good ex-communist could have without losing his political credentials. My difficulties began to arise when I discovered that to practice art, I went with other car makers to make music. But when I wanted to think about that art, I had to knock on the door of the other Oxford, which through secret codes and rituals were not so keen to enter into a dialogue with me. The English-British love of their borders, the watery ones and the class-based ones. Please note how we English are perfectly happy with interchanging the word Englishness with Britishness. I want to propose, perhaps against contemporary trends, that the British had a clear sense of Britishness and the other, perhaps right up until the 1990s. Evidently, many British cities had become and have become multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilinguistic, and multi-religious over the previous 40 years, indeed thousands of years. But despite this, I'm not convinced that mass immigration really impacted on notions of Britishness for 90% of the population. In fact, in recent years, it's learned to enjoy, cherish in many ways, its borderlands, but always within its borders. clearly defined borders has had something to do with it. The grey mist with which stopped us from seeing where the sea began was the only ambiguity with which the border was accustomed to for thousands of years. But English hostility to the outside world and sense of cultural and economic superiority is still regularly employed as a means to define identity. And it seems that the teenager in my distant past intuitively recognised that his sense of cultural self, restricted or otherwise, was inextricably linked to geography and boundaries in the same way as generations of his antecedents. We shared a remarkable, similar geo-imaginary landscape as Shakespeare and Churchill and Hardy and Dickens. Their manifestations of Englishness were for millions acknowledged and effortlessly appropriated as definitions of Britishness. But I am a European. I managed to find a gap in the grey mist and took a ferry to France when I was 16, and it changed my life. I stayed a week, and when I got home, I told my dad everything, and he had nothing to say. And then a week later, he said, "Did you go near Germany?" "No," I replied. Such a mad idea at that point had not even entered my head. And of course, a major part of any definition of being English or British is our relationship with Germany. Two world wars, the lone fight against Hitler until America and the Soviet Union joined in, Britain alone, is still a decisive emotional trigger till today. We're used to it. We like it. We recognise it. We are willing to accept its consequences. But of course, it never was the case. Splendid isolation, with a myth which is shared with many nationalist identities, is also an English tendency which exposes a slight tendency towards the autistic in the English character. In the end, we all know that groups exist, and that we all probably belong to one, or two, or three, or four of them. Europeans have no shared language in which to talk about this, and groups or consequences of belonging to so many. But most nations do. Europe still believes that it has no narrative to explain itself, and the moral panic about multiculturalism in Europe is one of the many crises we are facing as a result. But could my dad's fear of war in general — he was a member of CND, the peace movement, and he retired early to help the Green and Peace Women in the last 10 years of his life struggle against the nuclear weapons that the Americans dumped on us — could his fear of war in general, and of Germany in particular, actually make him a more typical European than me? I've lived outside the UK for decades now. I'm fluent in Spanish. I've spent decades working in cultural institutions in Germany and Spain and elsewhere, and I cherish my European credentials above any other of my identities. But does that make me more European or less? I think I'm an abnormal European. Perversely, this obsession with divisions, plus our unwillingness to find ways of talking about Europeanness or borderlanderness in a popular and accessible way with communities with whom we work, have, in my opinion, become the dominant factors which have led us at this point of the development in the European project to be wholly unprepared for the onslaught of the crisis of capitalism. As David Markand reminded us, despite the Lisbon Treaty, the European project is still mired in a shameful paradox. The Union has been an extremely successful agent of democratisation, perhaps the most successful in democracy's long contested history. With all its imperfections and shortcomings, the incorporation of 10 former communist countries in Eastern Central Europe, some of them strangers to democracy before their absorption into the Soviet Empire, has widened the reach of democratic self-government, rule of law, and perhaps most importantly, the extension of human rights. Just the same as the incorporation of Portugal, Spain and Greece did so in the 1980s. The change has come so quickly and so peacefully that it is easy to assume that it was foreordained. Nothing could have been further from the truth. I have not drifted too far away from Chris's question, I hope: what can we see from the borderland? From the borderland, we see borders, and we can see land, and we can experience borderlands. It's not the desire for borders or the desire for borderland competences which define us as being more or less agile Europeans. It is our ability to negotiate between the two which will decide our fate as a continent. As the aggressive impact of the globalised financial markets erode our fragile European solidarity, old instincts, I'm sure, will come to the fore. The older, more primitive brain, which reach out for the emotional security of well-rehearsed behaviours, for our nationalisms, our clear borders, while at the same time attempting to suffocate our enlightenment-driven desire for a Europe built on shared values, is all around us. If we cannot press ahead in explaining why European solidarity is key to defending our social values, a shallowed-out concept of Europe as a place for borderless holidays and unrestricted consumption opportunities for the rich will be a result. And Marie Le Pen will smash Sarkozy and become the dominant right-wing party after this election. In doing so, she will teach her brethren across Europe a useful trick or two. That's my worry, that Marie Le Pen's enemy is not the socialists or the left. It's that centre-right party. And when she can destroy them, she'll have the field to herself. From the borderland, what do we see? No less than this. In an attempt to participate by cultural tools in the reconfiguration of the imagination to promote a Europe, a world of values, of the mind, of the imagination, of creativity, of hope. I don't see a world where there are no borders and no borderlands, but I do see a world full of people more competent at negotiating those borders, using those borderlands to create new identities and celebrate and remember the old, to remember the defunct and remember the life-affirming identities too. Thank you.